From New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Back in the late 1970s, Scott Billington had a choice to make. He could continue working as the manager of a popular record store in Boston, or maybe make records with a group of hippies who shared his musical tastes. They loved regional music that today would be called Americana. Billington chose the hippies, and so began his association with Rounder Records.
From a financial standpoint, going to work for Rounder Records certainly wasn't the best decision I could have made at the time, but it was one of the best decisions I ever could have made.
Rounder helped bring wider acclaim to scores of artists. Clarence Gatemouth Brown, Irma Thomas, and Bobby Rush won Grammy Awards for albums that Billington produced. Scott Billington talks about bringing out the best in music after the break. A record producer needs a discerning ear, a reliable gut, and a heart that goes pitter-patter when the music sounds right. Some producers discover new artists and introduce them to the listening audience. Others collaborate with established acts to find new dimensions to their creativity. Either way, it's an intimate relationship. By the end of a project, the record producer knows an artist inside out. Scott Billington is a three-time Grammy Award-winning producer who's championed American roots music since high school. Beginning in the late 1960s and early 1970s, when he joined Rounder Records, his collaborations have helped any number of artists reach their potential. Just listen to a corner of Billington's resume.
Pictures and paintings are etched in my head of a face that was perfect that someone else kisses in bed. Now all I am left with, all that I have, are pictures and paintings etched in my soul.
Charlie Rich, Nathan and the Zydeco Cha-Chas, Irma Thomas, and Clarence Gatemouth Brown are just a few of the artists who've put their faith in Scott Billington as producer. We spoke with Billington at Marini Studios in 2016 and asked him whether the studio is where he feels most comfortable.
That's the thing I love most, when I have a group of musicians in the studio supporting an artist, particularly a singer, and the communication is flowing and the vibe is there and we're capturing a spirit in the studio. It's just the most wonderful feeling.
It must be, because it can't be the actual space, you know, because studios are normally very dark, windowless places, you know, you find the crumbs of somebody else's meal.
Oh, sure.
And you know, sometimes there's like an insect problem, you know, old cigarette butts, you know what I mean? So it can't be the place as much as it is the spirit within it.
It is. And it's actually a difficult place sometimes in which to summon the spirit, because if you hear an artist at their best in front of an audience and they're getting feedback from the audience and in the moment, the performance they'll give sometimes is what inspires you to want to work with them. All of a sudden, you bring them into this relatively sterile environment. It's the producer and the engineer, the musicians, maybe there's an assistant there, and the walls. there's nobody to interact with.
Exactly.
Except for, you know, the chemistry between the artist and the musicians and me and the engineer. So getting to that point where you summon a great spirit to come and inhabit the place is always a challenge.
Absolutely. Now, you were originally from Massachusetts?
Yes.
Outside Boston?
Yes. And I was there for many, many years. I grew up partly in Arizona and in New Jersey. My dad had a job that had us move around quite a bit.
What did he do?
He was a chemical engineer for the American Sugar Company.
Wow.
And when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened in the 60s, the American Sugar Company lost its sugar plantations in Cuba. And that's how we ended up in Arizona. He went out there to help build a beet sugar refinery, and they were planting beets in the ground at the same time the refinery was being built.
Gee. And do beets really grow in Arizona?
Sugar beets, yeah. These giant, giant beets. They look like grapefruit, and they made sugar out of them somehow.
Your dad lived in sugar, and yet you're so thin.
Oh, I guess. My dad also piqued my interest in roots music very early because I can remember when I was 12 or 13 years old, he found out that there was a big festival in Guadalupe, which is the Mexican-American settlement next to Phoenix, and that there would be music there. And I was totally captivated by these big mariachi bands with the horn sections and the violins, and he had a real love for that kind of thing, too.
Voy a rendir homenaje a la canción mexicana. Voy a rendir homenaje a la canción mascariana, a la canción más primorosa, que es la canción mexicana.
And so did your mom work outside the house?
No, she was a homemaker. I also give her a lot of credit for getting me started in the music business because she got me a harmonica in my Christmas stocking when I was 11 years old, and she paid for it with a book of green stamps.
Oh, boy, I remember those.
Yeah, she traded in one book of green stamps for that harmonica, and I started to play it, learning the tunes in the little book that came with the harmonica. But then we moved to New Jersey, and when I was a sophomore in high school, we started going into the Village and hearing the Grateful Dead and the Mothers of Invention. And then I heard Paul Butterfield, the harmonica player from Chicago, and that just completely turned me around. Then my dad passed away when we were living in New Jersey. I was 14, and I think I just worked my way through everything by putting everything into learning the harmonica. Yeah, it was just something that grabbed me early on, blues music and American roots music in particular. When I was 17 years old, I wanted to go back to Arizona because that was a very happy time in my life. So I went to Northern Arizona University, and about a 1959 Ford panel truck from a TV repair company fixed up the holes in the floorboards with sheet metal and spray painted it bright yellow. And on my way to Arizona, I decided I'd head down south and look for blues records. And I was trying to be a hippie. I was growing my hair out. And when I was 17, I looked 14. And then I got to Memphis, found the record store downtown, Poplar Tunes. And they were playing records for me, but it seemed like more or less the same records I could have got in Boston. And this sounds like something out of a movie, but this little old man in kind of a rumpled suit came up and said, "Look, if you want records like that, I'm going to tell you where you should go." And he drew a map on the back of an envelope and sent me to Selecto Hits, which is still a record distributor in Memphis today, a one-stop.
What's a one-stop?
One-stop sells records to mom-and-pop stores, gas stations, places that don't want to deal with ordering records from record companies. They just get it all from this one place, and they put a rack in. It's not so popular as it once was, but it was quite a business at one point.
I guess Starbucks is now a one-stop.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
I'd like a latte and Bob Dylan, please.
That's right. Yeah, man. Anyway, Selecto Hits turned out it was owned by Johnny Phillips, who was the brother of Sam Phillips, who founded Sun Records, and there was just piles and piles of these 78s and 45s, and I still have them too.
Well, if people say I'm lazy, but it's a lot that they don't know. When I'm in the mood, I can go, cat, go, 'cause I'm a lover, not a fighter.
We have to move your lips, just shake your hips, and do the hip shake, baby, and do the hip shake, baby, do the hip shake, baby.
Talk about coming, oh yes I am, talk about coming, prison fall, oh yes I am. Talking about coming, oh yeah, yeah. Talking about coming, prison fall. Oh yeah. Now you heard part of my story. Hey. I'm not the only one.
You're talking about a period that, you know, in retrospect, people call sort of the blues revival period,
yeah,
right,
in
our history, where bands, as you say, like the Grateful Dead, and there's, of course, Taj Mahal and so many other artists who were plumbing American music, looking for either undiscovered blues or to bring attention to blues artists who had long since fallen out of favor, let's
mm-hmm.
say,
yeah.
and all. But what exactly were you hearing in the music that connected with you? You're a white kid from a middle-class family and,
mm-hmm.
you know, bouncing around the United States. I mean, what did you have in common with, you know, with Blind Willie McTell?
Yeah, nothing at all. And yet there was something about that music that pulled me in. The directness of it, the groove, the musicality, and I became involved with an organization called the Boston Blues Society in the early 70s. My friend Peter Guralnick, the writer, Dick Waterman, who lives in Oxford, Mississippi now, who was Bonnie Raitt's manager and a booking agent. There were a group of us. I was the junior member. And we staged concerts in the Boston area, usually at Harvard University. And we brought in people like Skip James, Mance Lipscomb, Dr. Ross, Son House, Joseph Spence from the Bahamas, Johnny Shines, Robert Jr. Lockwood. So that was the last of that original generation of blues players that had recorded in the late 20s and early 30s.
Well, let me ask you this. Now, you were the manager of a record store.
Mm-hmm.
Was it in Cambridge?
In Boston.
In Boston. Well, so how do you make the leap between record store manager and producer?
I'd gotten to know the founders of Rounder Records, Ken Irwin, Bill Nallen, and Marion Levy, through the store because I carried their records, and they would also come sell records at the Boston Blues Society shows. They'd set a table up outside and sell records. And they wanted to make their operation a little bit more professional in terms of sales and promotion. It was a logical decision that I should come and work for them. I also had a couple of offers back then from a couple of major labels. From a financial standpoint, going to work for Rounder Records certainly wasn't the best decision I could have made at the time, but it was one of the best decisions I ever could have made.
So are we talking Capitol Records or Columbia or Reprise?
Yeah, it was
or
Arista, ABC, Warner Brothers. I mean, all of them had talked to me at one point about mostly sales. They needed salespeople.
Those are big guns, though.
Oh, yeah.
They really
are. But I also thought, man, if I can just work for Rounder, maybe I could at least be a fly on the wall at a recording session.
Well, Scott Billington, I mean, you had some early success with Rounder in terms of bringing Rounder something that it had never had before, which is a Grammy Award,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely. That wasn't a bad way to start.
This is Clarence Gatemouth Brown?
Yeah. All Right Again.
All Right Again.
Mm-hmm.
That's Clarence Gatemouth Brown with the song Gate Walks to Board. Brown was known for many talents, but a patient man he was not. Coming up, producer Scott Billington on the art of remaining cool when the artist gets hot. Stay with us. This is a rebroadcast of Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We're talking with music producer Scott Billington, who brought Rounder Records and Clarence Gatemouth Brown their first Grammy Award. Brown was widely known as a blues guitarist, but he was perhaps better known as a persnickety individual. That may be why, at the 2004 Lightning in a Bottle celebration of blues music, Brown refused to call himself a blues artist.
I play American and world music, Texas style.
Clarence Gatemouth Brown was a kind of a cantankerous and an opinionated man. He demanded a lot of his musicians, too. He ran a tight ship, musically. His great joy in life was being on stage and entertaining people. And sometimes I think the rest of his life wasn't as easy for him. He just lived to be on stage.
Yeah, he was a sort of a notorious tough talker. I mean, yeah. The man could curse you out royal style.
He could.
You know, pretty easily. So my question to you, Scott Billington, is as a producer, you know, how do you respond to an artist who is so intransigent at times and unreasonable at times and, you know, kind of hard to be around sometimes?
Well, I think I'm a fairly even presence in the recording studio. Occasionally it means standing up too and saying, you know, hold on a minute, you know, this is kind of getting out of hand. I think probably the most dramatic example of that I can think of was working with James Booker. One of the great pianists of the last century, and a very sad individual. He was one of the loneliest people I'd ever met, and plagued with personality disorders and substance abuse issues. Very sweet guy underneath all of it, but we put quite a bit of pre-production into his record, and I still was very, very green at the time when I was working with James Booker. This was my baptism by fire, I think.
Here in New Orleans.
Yes. And Booker was engaged with the whole process of thinking about the songs he wanted to record. And yet when we got to the studio, he didn't want to play any of the songs we'd rehearsed. He stopped talking to us. When we did get him to play, he would just lead the musicians on a cat and mouse chase. As soon as everybody figured out where he was going and locked into that groove, he'd be likely to just take it somewhere else. He was just having a difficult time focusing.
This is for the Classified,
Classified
album?
Classified, yeah.
Okay.
And finally he went off into the corner and just kind of was crouching there. And I won't tell you the word I used, but it was, look, you know, either get over to the piano bench and play the piano, I'm going to cancel the session. This is ridiculous. And he very meekly walked over to the piano and started to play again. I don't think that did the trick, but I got to the studio on the third day just to listen to the tapes that we'd made, just to see if there was anything there that might be part of a record. And when I got to the door of Ultrasonic Studio, there was Booker standing out front in his suit, three-piece suit, saying, Scott, is it okay if I play now? It's like, James, let's go do it, you know? So he came around.
You know, Classified is our theme song.
Yeah, that's right.
Ever come to my house again, knock up on the door. Somebody's gonna tell you, baby, not to ever come back no more. Said, I know, I think I know. Baby, how you classified? Ain't no lie. I'm so glad something told me. Baby, just how you classified? That ain't no lie. to call me all out of my name. If you had my feelings, I'm quite sure you'd feel the same.
It can get rough in the studio, but in the end, you come up with a product that both you and the artist love.
Yes,
You know? Then does that forever change your relationship with that artist?
Oh, sure. It gets, if you've done that, you've got a friend for life. And it's all about playing to the artist's strengths. If you're leading somebody down a path that puts them in a place where they're uncomfortable or where their confidence is undermined, it's not going to work. So you have roses waiting for Ruth Brown when she gets to the studio.
Oh, yes.
You've got to take care of your artist.
Whisper sweet nothings the way you used to do. Pour some wine and tell me I'm the only one for you. Intoxicate my senses, knock me off my feet. Take me in your arms and rock your baby to sleep. I'll be good as new tomorrow if you'll be good to me tonight.
So it seems to me that the role of the producer is to sort of make connections that sometimes the artist cannot see for him or herself.
Oh, sure, sure. I think the best example of that for me might be with Irma.
Irma Thomas. As if there's more than one Irma.
No, I guess so.
Irma Green, Irma
right,
Guido,
right.
Irma Parker.
We'd been working together for almost a couple of decades, and almost always going for a sound that I would call 70s R&B or sort of based in that, with the horns and the Hammond organ and the piano. And I started thinking, boy, does Irma always have to be confined to that sound? Because her voice is so much more than that sometimes.
Yes.
And I just started thinking about songs and textures that would sound good behind Irma. I talked to her a little about it, and she said, yeah, you know, I'm open to it. You know, send me some things. Show me what you're talking about. And I put together a CD of a couple of new songs. There was one that David Egan, the songwriter from Lafayette, had written. There were some older folk songs, Make Me a Pallet on Your Floor.
That's my favorite on that album.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's the After the Rain album?
Yeah.
And then the David Egan song is If You Knew How Much.
Oh, yeah.
Gosh, that's a beautiful song.
And Eleni Mandel is a country song.
Yeah. Another Man Done Gone.
Yeah. So anyway, I said, Irma, I'm going to send you the CD. You may think I'm crazy, but let's just talk about it. And she got the CD, and she called me a few days later, and she said, Scott, have you lost your mind? What am I going to do with this stuff? I said, oh, well, I can hear it, you know? And she said, well, I'll tell you what. You know me well. I know you. I'm game. And then Katrina happened. Only a week before we were going to go into the studio to record the album. And we still kept it going and got together only 7 or 8 weeks later at a Dockside studio in Lafayette. And it was the first time that many of these musicians had seen one another since the storm. We had Stanton Moore on drums, James Singleton on bass, Corey Harris on guitar, David Torkanowski on keys, Chuck Elam, Juanita Brooks, Mark Broussard on background vocals, and David Egan, the songwriter, was there. And the song we started with, which is always a very crucial decision to decide what song you're going to start with, was the Arthur Alexander song called In the Middle of It All.
Yes.
Now, that's an older song.
Is it?
From the 60s. And Irma heard the groove. It was a very gentle groove. There was a lot of space for her in that track. And we were cutting live. And Irma just locked into that song and sang the vocal that you hear on the record.
My house is a lonely house, but it once was a happy house. And the two of us, we were so happy, as I recall. But now the rain falls around it, and loneliness surrounds it.
I'm in the middle of it all.
There wasn't a dry eye after that take, and we all came back into the control room, and she says, "Okay, I see what you're going for. You know, I'm with you." And that was the spirit in that record. And the eerie thing about it was that we'd chosen all of the songs but one before the storm, and all of a sudden every song seemed to be about what had just happened to everybody.
Exactly.
So it was a very emotional record. And there were no horns on the record. There were a lot of acoustic instruments. There's fiddle, there's fretless banjo. Textures.
Textures.
It's not a bluegrass record. There is just a different kind of framework for her. And that was the record that won her her first Grammy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That was the record that won her her first Grammy and you your second.
After 50 years in the business, Irma Thomas gets a Grammy. That was such a wonderful thing.
And I, in the middle of it all,
a lot of great producers out there, record producers. Obviously, Sam Phillips was one, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Over at Sun Records, you had people like Rick Rubin, who's you know, the king of the hill for so long with the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Metallica. And even Johnny Cash, you know, recorded with Rick Rubin.
Absolutely.
You know, and Babyface with his, you know, with the R&B sound, Usher and TLC and Tony Braxton and all that. Mm-hmm. But what is the Scott Billington sound? Or is there one?
I guess there's a Scott Billington sound. My favorite records are those that I've made with singers where I've had to construct something behind them. And I like to hire jazz musicians to play blues, actually.
Really?
Somebody like David Torkanowski, or the album we made with Dr. Lonnie Smith with Johnny Adams.
Who was the B3 organ player.
Yeah.
To hug and squeeze me, and you know I love it too. The way you treat me, baby, makes me know your love is true. 'Cause we'll be cooking in style. I love to be told that you care for me, and I love it all the while.
So they're sometimes they're raw, but they're usually not raw records. There's something that gently prods the artist to be their best, and to make us all feel something when we listen to that record.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And, you know, if I may impose my beliefs on you, I think that something that you do wonderfully is you are able to allow the artist to feel vulnerable and to explore loss in a way that most people would feel very uncomfortable doing.
Oh, sure.
You know?
Sure.
And somehow you create an architecture where the artist can look within and not look away from, not look away from heartbreak.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I wonder if that's something in you.
Could be. Not these days, but yeah, it's certainly something that it's universal too. I mean, people feel that. It's part of being human.
No one ever knew. I wanted to know the real me. When you stood beside me and somehow got inside me and you found the real me. You got through all the surprises, all those defenses and disguises, and found the real me. The real me. Your gentle touch made me strong, showed me the strength that I had all along. And you made all those tangled pieces unwind when you found the real me. The real me. When I look in the mirror, I no longer see the man I used to be. Now looking back at me, all I ever see the real me. All I ever see is the real me.
That was Johnny Adams singing The Real Me, a song written by Doc Pomus. Adams and Pomus were a magical pairing in music. Coming up, who was Kanye West before Kanye West? Producer Scott Billington has the answer. Stay with us. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is a rebroadcast of Music Inside Out. Lots of recording artists can perform a variety of musical styles. Look at Lady Gaga. But few can make as dramatic a change as we'll hear next. This is Charlie Rich.
Well, you can have her. I don't want her. She didn't love me anyway. She only wanted someone to play with. But all I wanted was love to stay.
And this is Charlie Rich.
You ain't been blue. No, no, no. You ain't been blue till you've had that mood indigo.
Our guest is producer Scott Billington of Rounder Records. Billington and music writer Peter Guralnick produced Charlie Rich's last album, which many say reflected his true identity as an artist. As it turns out, Rich's heart was not in country music. He was a jazz musician, hiding in plain sight.
He could play piano like Earl Garner, and he also understood down-home blues feel really well. The notorious Charlie Rich story is at the Country Music Awards, he was supposed to announce the Country Artist of the Year, and it was John Denver, and he opened up the envelope and took out his lighter and burned the announcement on national television.
This is like the early Kanye West.
yeah, exactly. yeah, Kanye's got nothing on Charlie there, does he?
Nothing on Charlie Rich, right, you know? But here's a guy who actually could sound like Elvis, you know,
yeah.
In that song, You Can Have Her, you
oh,
know?
Yeah.
And then he had this, like, incredible pathos in his voice where he, you know, I mean, obviously he sang those songs like When We Get Behind Closed Doors or
sure.
What was it? The Most Beautiful,
most
girl,
beautiful
in the world.
Girl in the World.
This is not just anybody.
No, he was a deep, deep singer. And he was a very vulnerable person, too. Man, you know, the wrong word would be like watching a cold wind blow across his face, and it would just shut him down.
What would be the wrong word?
boy, what would that be? And I saw it happen a couple of times, and it took some time to recover. Oh, that's not good enough, or that we're going down the road.
That makes sense. That's not good enough in the sense that, like, I mean, I see Charlie Rich as a very depressed person.
Oh, absolutely. And this was a record where he did express a very vulnerable part of himself.
What was the name?
It was called Pictures and Paintings.
Pictures and Paintings.
There was Am I Blue?
You Don't Know Me?
Yeah, You Don't Know Me is
that
on there.
That was a great
That's a beautiful performance.
Yeah.
And we did cut Feel Like Going Home. He and I were hanging out in his studio one night, and we hadn't cut the track yet. And he said, you know, I could hear a black gospel choir singing that song with me. I said, okay. We cut the track with the band that we had, Michael Tolles on guitar, Doug Garrison on drums, Beryl Thomas on bass, Charlie on piano. And I found a choir in Memphis through Michael Tolles. Now, Charlie wasn't in the studio that day, and they did a spine-tingling performance doing backup for Charlie. Some people might even think it's a little over the top, but knowing where Charlie was coming from, it worked. And I played it for him the next day, and he was just flabbergasted, like, yeah.
Lord, everything I done was wrong. Lord, I feel like going home.
How do you know when a song is finished?
That's the producer's number one role, I think, is to figure out when it's done.
It's a wrap.
Yeah, you can keep tinkering with something forever, but I don't work with huge recording budgets. This isn't a pop record with hundreds of thousands of dollars. None of them are. So, you know, I think that can actually work to your advantage sometimes, because you do have to say, okay, we went in here, we gave this our best, the musical performances are good, we're getting the emotion of these songs together, so it's done.
Let me ask you, Scott, let's talk about the golden age of Zydeco.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have spent a lot of your career not only recording Zydeco music, but really putting Zydeco music on the map in terms of it being a world music, a music that is just as trenchant, let's say, as any other folk music. Mm-hmm. And all. What is it that you hear in Zydeco that made you want to commit so to it?
Well, it's very bluesy music. It's like a lot of New Orleans music. It's very functional social music. People go out to dance to it. It's not the same thing as recording somebody like Johnny Adams or Irma Thomas. It's a lot more visceral, and it's about the groove.
I used to stay out all night long. Used to do a whole lot of wrong. I didn't know where I would end up. Didn't that sweet thing had to come along. See that sweet thing had to come along.
The first Zydeco records that I made were with Buckwheat.
Buckwheat Zydeco,
In the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually made both of those records in Massachusetts when he was on tour. Both of those got Grammy nominations. And the first one was a relatively straightforward document of what the band sounded like.
Now, no more.
But the second record was a little more adventurous. I was working with an engineer named Greg Lunsford at the time, and we started thinking about this, and it's like, this isn't all that different than reggae in terms of it being groove music for a community. And, oh, the last day of our sessions for that record, Waiting for My Yaya, I'd stayed up all night because we needed a couple more songs, and I was just looking through records and seeing what I could find, and I brought that Lee Dorsey song, Yaya, to Buck. And he said, all right, you know, I can hear something to do with that. And he went out into the studio and just sat down at the piano and started playing this little syncopated dun 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 dun. It was reggae. And within an hour of him playing that little piano motif, we had the whole track together and done.
Yeah, it really does make the argument that South Louisiana mm-hmm. really is sort of just the northern part of the
Caribbean.
Caribbean. That's really what it is, you know. Mm. But, you know, you have recorded a lot of these princes of Zydeco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
You know, Buckwheat,
as
you say.
But the princes.
The princes, yes. You know, Nathan and Nathan Williams, is that right?
Yes, Nathan Williams, senior. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And the Zydeco cha-chas. But then there's Bo Jacques, who, mm-hmm. of all of the artists that you talked about in writing and produce, you know, this seems to be a character who needs a Hollywood biopic.
Oh, you
know,
bet.
Starring a Hollywood A-list actor, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Because his musical career begins with the most dramatic episode that I've almost ever heard of, which is it began when he broke his back.
Yes. He was up on a tower working as an electrician, and a transformer exploded, threw him 25 feet to the ground, and he broke his back. And he'd been in the special services of the Army. He'd had a career in the military. And I think this is a pretty good job that he had had and probably would have lived his life working as an electrician.
And he was a big guy.
He was really big. He was probably 6'8" before he broke his back, and they had to remove several vertebrae, and he was still 6'6" after that. But after this accident, he had to use a wheelchair and was told that he might never walk again. And he stayed at his father's house in Doral, his mother and father recuperating, and his dad had an accordion up on the shelf. His dad was a very good Cajun Creole-style accordion player. Bo Jacques had heard this growing up. Andres Espre was his name, and his father was Sandres Espre. And while he was recuperating, he just started fooling around with the accordion, learning how to play it. And while he was still in a wheelchair, he and his wife, Shelley, started going to Zydeco dances to sort of study what was going on there, what it was that made people get up and dance and what was popular. And one day he just got up out of his wheelchair and started walking again.
Wow.
And put a band together. He came up with this sound that was undeniably fresh. He was a force of nature, and his vocals just seemed so deep. It was like listening to Howlin' Wolf or a very deep blues singer. He was a stream of consciousness performer, and I don't think anybody had done that quite to that degree in Zydeco before. And the bass player, Chuck Bush, is just an astonishing musician. He's still working today. He and Bo Jacques in particular played off each other. The drummer had this kind of high-pitched voice. He would yell back at Bo Jacques. He ended up having the nickname Mosquito because he was kind of like the mosquito who was always buzzing around.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bojack really did energize that scene. And you would go to Richard's Club in L'Hotel and see cars lined up half a mile in each direction on the highway.
Just to see him, huh?
Yeah, and there'd be people crammed into that club and spilling out into the parking lot. And I thought at the time, you know, we might glorify these music scenes from history. We think of 52nd Street in New York for bebop, or Memphis in the early 50s when the blues scene was starting and B.B. King was on the radio and Rufus Thomas was on the radio, or, oh, I don't know. We look back at these eras in music where something happened that left a permanent imprint on a particular genre. And that was happening right then and there in the 90s in South Louisiana when Bojack came back. And his influence is still felt today. That was just so much fun, you know?
So we've come to the end of our time together, which is terrible because it'd be fun actually to just sit and listen to records with you. Which I guess is what we've been doing. But anyway, but what song would you like to go out on, Scott Billington?
How about if we play one of the Tangle Eye pieces?
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Any in particular? Please say John Henry.
Oh, you wanted to?
That one is so good. I mean, they all are good.
All right, let's listen to John Henry. This is a record that another engineer partner and I made about 10 years ago, Steve Reynolds. We decided to do this idea of remixes using samples from Alan Lomax's Southern Journey recordings. We're actually so fortunate to get permission to do this. And most of the voices that we remixed were recorded solo to begin with. And what you hear is people who were singing as an expression of who they were. These aren't people who were singing because they thought they were going to have a career in music, or they were going to make money, or they were going to get on American Idol or whatever. It's kind of sobering and shocking to listen to people singing from that perspective. We lose that sensibility of how important music is to us as human beings, and it's part of our expression of what it means to be human. It isn't just about having a hit record or a dance hit or whatever. So this record was exactly the opposite of almost every other record I've made, in that we started with great vocal performances. It wasn't something we had to get. And it was like taking these beautiful old diamonds and putting them in new settings. That's what the Tangle Eye record is about.
John Henry, he says, a man ain't nothing but a man. Oh, I would die with my hammer in my hand. Oh, I would die with my hammer in my hand. Oh, I would die with my hammer in my hand.
This was somebody who was recorded in a Mississippi prison. Ed Lewis was his name. And he was chopping wood while he was singing the song. So you can hear the sound of his axe is kind of the snare drum sound in here. Lomax recorded people in prisons and churches, on their porches, in social situations. And this is a big part of who we are as Americans when you listen back to these voices. It was a lot of fun making this record. I hope we get to do another remix record of this nature in the future.
Yeah, and it takes you all the way back to your roots.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As a 15-year-old or 17-year-old,
sure,
listening to and playing this music.
Yeah.
Well, Scott Billington, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Gwen Tompkins. This has been a lot of fun. I really, really am thrilled to be here.
You've just been great, yeah. Scott Billington is a record producer with Rounder Records, and he's joined us here at Marini Recording Studio.
He says, a man ain't nothing but a man. Oh, I was standing to see your power driver beat me down. Would die with my hammer in my hand. Oh, I would die with my hammer in my hand.
And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Melissa McLean, Garrett Pittman, and Jason Rhine. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For a complete playlist of our show with Scott Billington and information about the children's music he makes with Johnette Downing in the duo Johnette and Scott, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Rosa Mary Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Studio, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.
Oh, well, the people long.